Newton v. LVMH, Louis Vuitton, et al. Mr. Rodriguez, I see you reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal, and you can begin whenever you're ready.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Max Rodriguez from the Law Office of Max Rodriguez on behalf of Appellant Endoa Newton. Your Honors, this case involves three key independent errors by the district court that violated precedents of this court and well-established standards of review. First, the district court did not adhere to the appropriate standard in assessing either the complaint or the proposed first amended complaint, which were considered simultaneously. The district court did not appear to consider numerous relevant allegations, drew inferences against Ms. Newton, and made factual determinations reserved to the jury, with the ultimate result being dismissal with prejudice of a plausible set of claims. Second, the district court dismissed with prejudice, as I just mentioned, and entered judgment immediately thereafter, preventing any cure of any supposed deficiencies, even though this court has held on multiple occasions that judgment without the opportunity to amend in these circumstances is legal error. Third, the district court denied the pre-motion to dismiss decision cross-motion for leave to amend, even though Ms. Newton asserted plausible claims arising from timely acts that were part of a retaliatory hostile workplace under the continuing violation doctrine, making this case factually and legally similar to this court's prior decision in Olivieri. The district court thereby failed to apply the EFAA to Ms. Newton's election to assert those claims. And
the EFAA says that the statute doesn't apply to claims that arise before the effective date, right?
It does, Your Honor. I think there are two independent reasons that we briefed why there would be an appropriate exception to that language here. The first of which is under the continuing violation doctrine, as this court previously applied in Olivieri.
Acts of retaliation that occur after the effective date is the termination, right?
There is the termination,
it's
but there's
Pratt who's like, intervening in her matters and that kind of thing, and then also the termination.
So there's a variety of categories that we briefed, and I'm happy to walk through them. Each of them has post-EFAA and timely instances that are included. So one is the intervention, micromanagement, setting her up to fail in matters. The most recent of those occurred in October of 2022. And assessing the merits of the claims in Olivieri, this court found that those were acceptable parts of a retaliatory hostile workplace claim. There's also-
If it's the same kind of conduct that's occurring before and after the relevant time bar, right?
Correct.
So like a termination can't be a continuation of a different kind of adverse action like a retaliatory hostile environment.
So if you're anchoring exclusively with respect to the termination under the Title VII and the New York State Human Rights Law analysis, that's correct. The New York City Human Rights Law analysis is more liberal and can encompass a termination, but even so, we're not relying on the termination to anchor a timely retaliatory act because there were other retaliatory timely acts that were part of the continuation.
If that's the case, though, the district court noted that you yourself said in your opposition brief below that it was materially different. The acts, the retaliatory hostile work environment before the passage of the act were materially different from the retaliation after, which you said was a retaliatory discharge. I understand now you're focusing on some of the other things that happened in that 4 month period, but if they're materially different, then I think by definition it's not a continuing violation. Right?
Well, it's correct that Ms. Newton's trial counsel did include that phrasing in the briefing below. As we briefed, I think fundamentally the district court was interpreting that language in a particular way that was inconsistent with the rest of the positions asserted in the brief. The rest of the positions asserted in the brief, stated a number of times that Ms. Newton was asserting a continuing violation.
Well, you could be asserting a continuing violation. I'm not saying it was waived. She was asserting a continuing violation, but in the course of the briefing on that, the lawyer says, they're materially different. One's about retaliatory discharge, and the other's about a retaliatory work environment, hostile work environment. I don't understand why the district court's not entitled to rely on that.
Well, I think the fundamental problem there, Your Honor, is that that's not what the council was referring to with respect to materially different, and there wasn't an opportunity because the record.
As a practical matter, those claims go to arbitration, and the other discharge, the other adverse action claims go to into the lawsuit, right? So it's not like in evaluating whether the termination was an adverse action, you need to look at the earlier evidence of social ostracism or making difficulties with her disability accommodations, because the termination itself is an adverse action, right? And Pratt intervening in her matters or micromanaging it or whatever is also different than not accommodating her disability or socially ostracizing her from the office. Right, so there's nothing about the earlier actions that is necessary to be considered in order to evaluate those acts of retaliation, right?
So if you're looking exclusively at the termination, they're potentially relevant facts. They're not necessarily part of the same pattern with a termination, but
there are, so if they're not part of the same pattern, then it means that it's not a continuing violation. It might be relevant. I mean, I agree, you look at all the facts when you evaluate a claim, that's fine. But the question here is whether when the claim accrued, and if in fact it's a distinct act, it's a distinct adverse employment action, then it accrues when that action takes place.
But
you don't need to, it's not part of the same adverse action.
Understood, Your Honor. I think the place where I differ is that, you know, across all of the multiple categories of what we identified in the briefing as continuing violation patterns of the retaliatory hostile workplace, each of them had an anchoring timely event, and each of them were similar in nature to other acts that previously occurred, you know, both post-EFAA and pre-EFAA. So that includes the intervention of micromanagement, which happened under Mr. Pratt and also under his predecessor.
So I guess another way of putting it would be, like, let's say you pursued the claim about the intervention of Pratt in the matters, and you lost. The conclusion was, for whatever reason, that did not amount to a retaliatory, discriminatory act. Would that ipso facto mean that the earlier adverse actions you would also lose? Like the social ostracism and the disability accommodation and that kind of thing?
Well, I don't think all of them rise and fall together, but I think fundamentally the thrust of what we articulate in the brief is that, you know, any one of those chains of continuing violation or all of them together were adequately pleaded and should have been allowed to proceed through the proposed first amended complaint, or for that matter, were this court to affirm that there were certain deficiencies in the pleading, that those were the types of deficiencies that could easily be cured through a second amended complaint, but no opportunity was provided.
About the adverse actions that Pratt took, the district court seems to think that that is and that you're alleging that that's in response to her refusal to go to the one-on-one meeting, right? Do you agree with that?
I see I'm over my time. May I continue to answer?
Sure.
So I think the fundamental difference there that we have with the district court is that that particular paragraph where that instance is described, one element of it is the refusal to participate in the meeting that was proposed concerning a settlement negotiation. But the problem with the district court's analysis is that that paragraph also included a number of plausible allegations about the other qualities under which Ms. Newton was engaged in protected activity, and that because she was engaging and responding to Mr. Pratt in that context, the company was aware of it. And that includes the continuing pursuit of her claims at that time in arbitration, although she has always wished to pursue them and elected to pursue them in court. And then in addition to that, her right to be free from this covered conduct under the EFAA in the workplace. And those allegations were included in that same paragraph, but were not included in the analysis of the district court.
You're saying it's retaliation not just for the refusal to go to the meeting, but also for other statements she's making and so on.
Other statements and other conduct, including the continued pursuit of the claims that is intrinsically tied up with the fact that she's not entering into this meeting.
The district court's conclusion that there's no allegation that they knew what she was speaking about at these conferences or about the social media posts. What's your response to that?
So I think in the first instance, Your Honor, the district court didn't permit a very plausible inference that by virtue of the fact that Mr. Pratt was entering into sort of additional processes with Ms. Newton to attempt to bar her from participating in these, that there's a very plausible inference from the complaint as pleaded that they then knew that she participated in them anyway. Indeed, she was fired a few weeks after that.
Yeah, I mean, there's this allegation that he objected to it, but then she did it anyway. Does that mean that he asked to review it and maybe said it's not a good idea, but like they didn't actually bar her from doing it? Is that what I should infer from the complaint?
I think that inference can fairly be drawn, especially because this isn't sort of, this isn't a type
okay,
of...
Okay, so if he asks for approval and then he says, well, I don't know if this is a good idea, but like I'm not going to stop you from doing it, then why wouldn't you then infer that they knew what she said at the conferences?
I think that's exactly right. I think that's the... I think it's exactly right that the inference can be drawn that if you are paying enough attention to where she's speaking, that you are trying to stop her from speaking.
Saying, actually, it doesn't seem like they're paying that close attention. If what they're saying is, I'd like you to come for approval, but they never really disapprove any of it, it's not obvious that they are paying close attention to what she's saying at the conferences.
Well, to the extent that's your inclination, Your Honor, I think basically, you know, corporate knowledge of that type, especially the type that's exclusively in the possession of the defendant, can be pleaded on information and belief. And so to the extent there was a need to add some additional facts about Louis Vuitton's patterns and practices with respect to these things, and Ms. Newton would know, having been an attorney.
And you could say something like that. What is the pattern and practice that you would add to a complaint to show that they would have known all the statements she was making?
Well, there were a number of things, Your Honor. So one of them is that, in fact, there were multiple employees of the company that liked or engaged with Ms. Newton's social media posts. In addition to that, there appeared to be a private investigator that was monitoring her social media posts. And on top of that, it was common practice in these situations to be tracking the activities and public statements at issue, because Ms. Newton was a current counterparty at that time in an arbitration. And so there are plenty of plausible inferences that could be pleaded on information and belief to fill that gap to the extent that gap is meaningful to Your Honor.
So just as a general matter, you know, if the allegations are that she made a complaint about sexual harassment and the company does an internal investigation and then does an external investigation and then is defending a lawsuit, is it really plausible that after taking her complaint so seriously that they ultimately then decide to fire her for it? Like, don't the allegations show that they're responding to the allegation of sexual harassment?
No, I don't believe they do, Your Honor. I mean, I think that, you know, we walk through this in the brief and it's in the complaint, but fundamentally at every step internally prior to the filing of the first lawsuit in state court, the company was doing everything possible to stop Ms. Newton from formally raising this as a complaint to HR, and then resisted at every possible opportunity to actually commence any kind of investigation. When they then commenced the investigation, it did not, in my view, have any of the marks of taking the situation seriously or taking her allegations seriously, because fundamentally, the investigator made veiled but not particularly subtle threats concerning her career by virtue of the fact that she had asked for this investigation. The company made public inflammatory comments about her after she decided to pursue her claims later, and took sort of every step at every juncture to penalize her for having raised these concerns, escalated them, and then ultimately, when it was clear the company was never going to take them seriously, litigating them.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
You have your 3 minutes in the bottom. Ms. Shaw.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Maureen Shaw from Quinn Emanuel, Urquhart & Sullivan for Appellees. And with the court's permission, I'd like to begin by addressing the district court's dismissal of the claims, federal retaliation claims that Ms. Newton pleaded in her operative complaint. And I would submit to the court that the inquiry here should start with the claims that Ms. Newton actually chose to include in her operative complaint, rather than and before turning to the claims, proposed new claims and allegations that Ms. Newton chose not to include in her operative complaint. And the reason I say chose not to is because, as the court may know, Ms. Newton had plenty of opportunities, ample opportunity, both before filing her initial complaint and even thereafter, to amend her complaint to include these proposed new claims and allegations as of right. And she voluntarily chose not to for her own, what the district court deemed, tactical reasons, in order to subject herself to a motion for leave to amend, which comes with it naturally, discretionary leave standard and futility review. And so we are in that realm by virtue of the choices
on that,
that she
note,
has
I
made.
Mean, I wanted to focus on the district court's determination that the student's allegation that defendant Pratt wanted to meet with her one-on-one to discuss settling the lawsuit was not protected, her declination to do that, whether she overtly rejected it or just ignored him. Now, that is not protected activity.
Certainly, Your Honor. It's not protected activity for two reasons. The first is making an overture from an employer to seek to settle an ongoing litigation, if that could be the basis for a subsequent retaliation claim, would chill the public policy that is very favored in this court.
Before we get to chilling public policy, let's take a step back. The lawsuit itself mm-hmm. is protected activity, right?
Yes.
So if a plaintiff, in the course of their lawsuit, suing for sexual discrimination, takes certain actions in the lawsuit, doesn't take certain actions in the lawsuit, and the lawyer retaliates against her for that, how can that not be actionable?
Because
suppose he pulled her into her office and said, Ms. Newton, I asked you to sit down with me to discuss the settlement. This has been hanging over the company's head for a long time. I was trying to resolve it. You won't even meet with me. You're fired. Would that be actionable or not?
I don't know whether that would be actionable, Your Honor, and we don't dispute that it may be, but that's
not actionable. She's being fired because she's refusing to settle a discrimination case. An employee doesn't have protection for that?
Because protected activity is activity where an employee is protesting acts made illegal under Title VII.
Right. So, and so I don't reasonably understood by an employer that if a plaintiff doesn't want to meet with them, that they're continuing to oppose what they believe is discrimination at the company. Isn't that a reasonable, we have to draw all reasonable inferences in her favor that he understood that is that she's going to continue this lawsuit and they want it to end, so they're going to fire her. We can talk about whether it's plausible or not, but I'm just having a hard time understanding how that could be unprotected by our retaliation laws. Highly problematic.
I think let me address Your Honor's question more directly then, because apart from the hypothetical about whether it could or could not be protected activity in certain circumstances, in this case, based on her own allegations, she has pleaded that it is not. And she pleaded in her complaint that the reason that she refused to take the meeting with Mr. Pratt was because she viewed it as potentially being unfair and subject to an imbalance in power to take that meeting. Those were her own allegations.
I don't see that. I'm looking at page 285. She said she was scared and appalled that her new boss was pressuring her to meet one-on-one without her attorneys present to settle the sexual harassment and retaliation claims. She continued to assert her rights. I don't see her saying that it was for some other reason other than she was continuing to impose what she alleged was discrimination.
I will find a site for Your Honor when I can, but I believe it's contained in
okay,
our briefing.
Well, regardless of whether what she subjectively believed were the reasons why she didn't do it, wouldn't the employee who's refusing to take the meeting have to at least explain that they're refusing to take the meeting out of opposition to sexual harassment? So if she said, I don't want to take the meeting because I think the company is engaging in a sham investigation and you're just going to pressure me to settle the lawsuit, that might be an act of opposition. But if she says, I'm not going to take a meeting because, you know, I don't like you or, I don't know, some other independent reason or, you know, I think I might get a bigger settlement if I keep litigating, it might not be, right?
That's exactly right, Your Honor, and it goes to the element of knowledge, right? As part of a retaliation claim, you need to show both protected activity and the employer's knowledge that it was protected activity.
In her favor, so why isn't a reasonable inference if someone's refusing to engage in settlement discussions that they want to pursue their claim of discrimination? Why wouldn't an employer, it doesn't matter what her subjective reasons are, it's what would be reasonably understood by the employer. Right? Isn't that the test? I could read it. The test is what could be understood or could reasonably be understood in connection with what the plaintiff is doing. So when a plaintiff says, I'm not settling, I don't want to meet with you to settle this case, even if they don't give any reason, why couldn't an employer understand that she's continuing to pursue her lawsuit?
Because there are many reasons why she might choose not to meet with her new supervisor to discuss settlement and choose to pursue it or settle in a different way. I don't think, respectfully, Your Honor, that is a plausible inference.
Right,
and here
assume,
she has not pleaded it.
Let's assume that we find that that's protected activity. I mean, they also assert other activity in terms of speaking at conferences. That's not the only one. To me, that was the clearest one. But why wouldn't it be plausible that if within 4 months of that protected activity, the general counsel who asked for the meeting, and she doesn't respond or rejects it, fires her in, I think, 4 months, right? Yes or no?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor, that there is more of a temporal proximity there, but temporal...
That's pretty close. That's pretty close, right? 4 months is pretty close.
4 months is not actually pretty close under the standards that of the cases that we have cited.
Between, and there wasn't silence in between. She alleges that there were other things. Maybe there wouldn't be separately enough to rise to the level of a retaliation claim, but as Judge Menasche said, we can look at the totality, right? And the totality is, after that refusal to meet with him, he said, I want to approve anything you speak about, right? You have to get approval.
That is correct, Your Honor.
That had never been done at the company before, right?
I don't know that that's correct, Your Honor.
Well, at least based upon the complaint, nobody had ever told her she'd spoken to Congress.
I think
she
has alleged that
approval.
She had not been subject to that requirement before.
She alleges that he started inserting herself in her client communications, excluding her from communications with clients. So there are other things besides what is a pretty close temporal proximity that he was not happy with her.
Well, I would have two answers for Your Honor. The first being temporal proximity is a factor, but even under the cases that find that temporal proximity can be a proxy for causation in the absence of other direct evidence of causation, of which here there is none. Those cases find that the temporal
proximity... You don't need other direct evidence of causation. You could be other circumstantial evidence of causation. That's what she's pointing to.
Well, she is not pointing to other circumstantial evidence of causation. She is pointing to other circumstantial evidence of alleged retaliation, which she says, based on temporal proximity, you can infer causation. The problem here is that under this prevailing case law, even for temporal proximity to act in place of an inference of causation, it has to be followed very close in time. And 4 months is, in fact, among the outer limits of circumstances where courts will find that temporal proximity itself can be used to have an inference of causation.
That, she refused the meeting, and then he's kind of hostile to her in the conduct of the work, and then eventually fires her. Why doesn't that suggest that it could be related? It's not as if there's just nothing happening in the gap between the action and the termination.
I think you have to take each of those instances individually, because there is the settlement meeting, or the suggested settlement meeting, where she says after that his conduct changed, right? And the conduct that she alleges changed after that includes refusing to give her permission to speak on panels, requiring permission to speak on panels, and then ultimately her termination. Those are really the salient acts that she alleges are retaliation here. And the reason that can't be enough is for the reasons that the district court said. Number one, the settlement meeting, not a protected activity. I know we've had discussion about that. Number two, there's no plausible allegation that Mr. Pratt, who is the actor she is identifying here, had knowledge of protected activity. And this is not simply knowledge that she intended to speak on a panel, because that is really the activity that we're speaking about here. He has to know that it's protected activity such that it could
be
inferred that he rehabilitated as a result.
About the statements at the conference, but I guess just if you accept Judge Bianco's hypothetical that the refusal of the meeting is protected activity, then you might understand the wanting permission to speak on conferences as not necessarily even responding to what she says there, but just trying to make her life difficult, and then you fire her within 4 months. And so then if the protected activity is just the one-on-one meeting, then you have kind of like hostility and then termination within a short period. So why wouldn't that be an inference that it might be causally related to the activity?
I would say, Your Honor, because those instances still are separated in time, many of them don't rise to the level that courts have found constitute protected retaliatory activity. As the district court found, many of these things that she points to are more appropriately categorized as petty slights.
So that's a different kind of thing. So then you think maybe asking for, you know, saying that the employer should know if she's going to do public speaking or whatever is not even an adverse employment action. And so we shouldn't even understand it as retaliation.
I think that's correct, Your Honor.
It doesn't have to be, right? Petty slights, if they show some hostility, that ultimately determination are permissible, even if they're not separately actionable, they can be considered looking at the whole.
Well, they can be considered when you're assessing whether it's part of a continuing violation, but they can't be considered on their own as retaliatory activity.
If they don't rise to the level of retaliatory activity. They can go to assessing the motive, whether it's retaliatory or not, right? I want to go back to something you said. Isn't it a reasonable inference that if she's being asked to speak at a Women in Influence and Power conference, and the panel is about how women successfully passed the most bipartisan transformative law ending the silencing of sexual misconduct, that is protected activity? Like, when the company, if she's asking for approval, the suggestion that the company had no idea what it was about, how can you get approval for something if you don't know what it's about?
Not suggesting that the company had no idea what the conference general topic was to be about, but they didn't know what her statements would be at it. And
so we shouldn't draw a reasonable inference that they understood she was going to be opposing, saying something against discrimination at that conference?
I think there is a higher standard of knowledge when you want to impute knowledge to an actor who therefore is said to have retaliated as a result of the activity. I do think the law requires a higher standard of knowledge and a more particularized standard of knowledge of what the protected activity is for a court to draw an inference, as they must hear, that the retaliation many months later was as a result of what she said and did.
Can I ask a general question about, maybe we don't need to decide this to resolve this case, but I'm curious about it. So, she makes a complaint of harassment. The company investigates it internally and then also externally. They conclude that it didn't happen, right? She thinks that that was a sham, and so continues to make public statements that Louis Vuitton is discriminatory and whatever. I guess I would think that at some point the employer is entitled to require the employee to accept their resolution of a complaint. But at the same time, if you go around saying, you know, it was a sham, then I guess that is an action opposing discrimination. So do you think that there is a point at which it's no longer protected activity if the employer has done an investigation, or is it always protected activity into the future?
I think, with apologies for using the phrase, it depends on what the it is. Mm-hmm. I don't think having asserted a claim, lawsuit, registered disagreement with the results of the investigation, and then sitting passively by while continuing to pursue that claim constitutes just ongoing ephemeral protected activity. The law requires something more concrete and discrete. I do think if she were making affirmative statements that the employer knew about, that did oppose practices that are rendered illegal by Title VII, those could constitute separate instances of protected activity. That's not what's alleged here. And I think—
So you're not disputing that her statements at the conferences would be or are protected activity. You're just saying there aren't sufficient allegations that the employer knew about them.
Well,
the media post for that matter.
Yes and no, Your Honor. I don't think we can say whether her statements at the conferences were or not protected activity because she has not pleaded what they were. And so that is a problem we confront here again and again with respect to this complaint. And I would say this is not—
So if the statement were something like, it's good to have public policies that make it harder for discrimination to occur in the workplace.
I don't know that that's protected activity, Your Honor. I don't know that that's protected activity.
What's the line then? Is that because it's like a advocacy of a public policy as opposed to an actual discrimination
Correct.
In the workplace?
Correct.
So is that what it is? So if it's kind of advocacy for legislation or something, that's not a protected activity, but if it is opposition to what the employer is doing to the employee, it's protected activity?
I think those are two examples where you could draw the line in between. Yes, I don't think
I
you need to decide that to decide this case.
Would matter if the conference panel that she's on is about ending the silencing of sexual misconduct claims. That has to be protected activity, right? No matter what her remarks are. If the employer, if she says, I'm going to that, the employer doesn't see her remarks. The employer says, you're fired. We'd have to see her remarks to know whether or not she was opposing discrimination by being at a conference where that's the title?
I think you do, Your Honor, because in an extreme example, she could, and I apologize for extreme examples, but I am wary of hypotheticals. In an extreme example, she could have gotten up on that panel and said something about what she ate for lunch that day and sat down. Now, I realize that's absurd.
Well, it's also absurd in the context of this case because she has a long history. She spoke to Congress. We know what her views
yes,
are.
It's
not like nobody knew what she was going to talk about, whether she was going to be opposing or you know, what side she was going to take on the issues. So.
It does, though, exemplify, I think, why you can't draw that large of an inferential gap. And I would like to point out here, Your Honors, this is not a litigant for whom she has not had many chances to explain in detail exactly what she is alleging.
I wanted to ask you about the can we, she has several paragraphs about how she was terminated, like the day of termination. And isn't that something we can also consider? She goes through some paragraphs where at least there's an inference that she was humiliated on the day that she was terminated. Isn't that something we can consider as well?
I think it is something you can consider, but her problem still is that she cannot connect her termination, which happened at the beginning of 2023, to...
So you would agree that at least the allegation suggests that there was an effort to humiliate her that day?
I would not agree that there was an effort. I would agree that you could infer that from the allegations.
Why would they instruct her to leave within 1 hour? It's not in the complaint. I think it's somewhere that it was ostensibly because of a restructuring or downsizing.
That's correct.
But there was no allegation that it was misconduct or anything like that. Why would she be instructed, even though her termination date was a month away, to leave immediately? Give up her badge. People are counting down the minutes as she's barking the countdown of the minutes as she's leaving. There's other things in there as well. It seems like a pretty unusual situation for a restructuring.
She certainly alleges it that way, Your Honor. I can think of many reasons why it's typical practice for employers to escort employees out of a building right after they're terminated, even if the effective date pursuant to a notice period is not till a month later. That happens quite routinely. But I understand Your Honor's point that she certainly does allege it that way. I still don't think that is sufficient because she cannot connect the termination, which is the adverse employment action, to a protected activity that comes close enough in time to present an inference that it was caused. And remember, this is a new supervisor who has, even by her own account in her own complaint, acted, quote, reasonably pleasant to her for many weeks after he was first came on board. And her termination then doesn't happen until many, many months later. This is 6 months after this intervening change. And so on the circumstances of this case, I do think the termination, which is the primary adverse employment action that she identifies as a retaliatory action in the complaint, is not temporally connected.
The replacement of Firestone by Pratt?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the beginning of your question.
When you say intervening change, that's the replacement of Firestone by Pratt?
That is one, but I think there are many, yes.
What is the other intervening change?
So the quality of the alleged retaliation changes before Firestone is replaced by Pratt, the types of retaliatory activity that she alleges fall more within the ambit of traditional hostile work environment. Ostracization, interfering in her matters, attempts to belittle her. That is the quality of the retaliation that she alleges under Firestone, who she alleges was the primary actor. Now, after Pratt replaces Firestone, the quality of the retaliation that she alleges changes.
I guess I understand, certainly for the state claims that are alleged only against Pratt, mm-hmm. I mean, he can't be liable for stuff that he didn't do.
That's correct.
So the change, makes a difference for the purpose of those claims. But for the Title VII claim that's against the employer itself, in principle, it could be that there is leadership of the company that's engaged in an overall course of conduct against her, and so it's not necessarily meaningful that the general counsel, her direct supervisor, has changed. But I guess you're saying what? It necessarily is, or it's because the nature of the actions change, and so that's the inference, or she doesn't allege that there's some higher level person who's orchestrating it? What's the reason why, when we're talking about a claim against the employer overall, the change in the direct supervisor matters?
I think it's all of those things, Your Honor, and I would urge the panel to look at the McCollum case. It's a case from this court from 2010, which deals exactly with this circumstance and which says when you're looking at whether there's a continuing pattern of conduct, you look at, among other things, whether they are sufficiently related to each other. And in that kind of circumstance, changes in supervisor, changes in department, can make a difference. Temporal proximity or discontinuity can make a difference. The quality of the retaliation alleged can make a difference. And these types of things all make a difference in terms of whether you can assess this to be a continuing pattern of conduct or something different. And here it was something different on many accounts by her own allegations.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, Mr. Rodriguez, you have 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Thank you. So I'd just like to cover a couple of issues. So with respect to causation, I think as some of the questions we're getting at, the causation that's pleaded here is temporal proximity. I would urge this court to look at its prior decision in the Banks case, which held that eight months or more in the temporal proximity analysis can be sufficient. So even in a circumstance where we were limited to evaluating what we can colloquially call the proposed settlement meeting, there were other matters at issue in that paragraph.
The settlement meeting, so right, so the district court says that that's not a protected activity. It is true that your client didn't explain why she isn't taking the meeting, right?
That's correct, but fundamentally...
So don't you think, like, for it to be an act in opposition to discrimination, she has to say something like, I don't want to meet with you because I think you're not... dealing with my claims in good faith or something like that?
Well, I think that's fundamentally what Judge Bianco's question was getting at, which is that the decision to continue... So in a posture where you've asserted claims and you are pursuing them and there's an invitation, an overture for a settlement discussion, I don't think you can disentangle a claimant's, a plaintiff's decision about how they're going to engage with that proposed settlement meeting.
She is still working at the company and they have to figure out a way to live together, right? And so maybe he's trying in good faith to come up with a way to live together. And so if she just sort of thinks, no, I just hate everybody here and doesn't want to take the meeting, that's one thing. If she thinks that actually it's trying to pressure her to give up her claims, then that might be in opposition to, like, there's a lot of inferences you could draw about why it is somebody wouldn't take the meeting. Some of them seem to be opposition to discrimination, and some of them might not be. So why shouldn't the rule be that she at least needs to make clear the reason why she's refusing to meet with the supervisor?
Well, I think there's two components there, Your Honor. I think one is that you know, the complaint doesn't allege that he asked her to come have a bagel and she assumed that it was about a settlement conference. The allegation is that he asked to have a settlement conference about pending claims that she had. So that's not really a circumstance where the meeting is about trying to figure out how to live together. It's about figuring out how to resolve her claims in a manner that, from his perspective, would be favorable to the company. So I think that's slightly different. I think the other thing is that to the extent we can identify one plausible set of inferences based on plausible allegations that would lead to a conclusion that's protected activity, that's the inquiry at this stage. I think hypothetically, if the company wishes to assert some other alternative factual basis for that settlement meeting, proposed settlement meeting, that's a question for the fact finder.
Isn't it also, I mean, during the course of a litigation, a plaintiff makes all kinds of decisions regarding the litigation where they don't explain the reasons for them at each point, but it's certainly if the employer retaliated against them based upon any of those decisions, it would be actionable, right?
Precisely.
If a lawyer stood up in the court, and the lawyer for the company said, Your Honor, we want a settlement conference, and the lawyer said, Your Honor, I spoke to my client, she's not interested in settling this case. And the next day, she gets called into the office and says, your lawyer stood up in court, said they don't want to settle this case, you're fired. Even though the lawyer didn't give any reason for why she didn't want to settle the case, that would certainly be a retaliatory act, right?
Yes, I agree with you, Judge Bianco. I think fundamentally, once a party is in the position that they've asserted claims and they're maintaining them, it's very hard to disentangle any decision, whether communicated by inaction or action statement or lack of statement. It's very hard to disentangle that from the core protected activity of asserting claims arising from...
But there could be things to do in a litigation that wouldn't be protected. I mean, I'm not saying that this is true of your client, but it could be that, you know, some employee sometime admits, like, the whole thing was made up, but she's trying to make a lot of money off of it, in which case, if the employer fires her for that, it's abuse of the process. It's not, you know, genuine discrimination, right? Or if, like, somebody doesn't show up to court, like, it's not like somebody would say, well, I didn't think it was a fair process, and so therefore we're not going to, you know, take an adverse action against your claims. Like, we think that there's some things you have to do. So there are things you can do in litigation that would just be abusive or would not be excused, right? So shouldn't we evaluate the nature of the thing? We can't just say whatever one does in litigation, it's automatically a principled opposition to discrimination.
I think there's hypothetical possibilities that other kind of, I guess what you could call, you know, ministerial or bad faith or whatever it is, conduct arising out of litigation decisions could hypothetically lead to that. I just submit that it's not sort of an issue that the court needs to reach in this case because none of those circumstances are present here.
All right. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Appreciate the arguments. We'll reserve the decision. Have a good day.